Good afternoon. This is KC Counts. Happy to be joined today by two attorneys, Jessica Streeter of Streeter Law Firm, LLC, and Alan D. Gluth of Gluth Law, LLC. Many people are thinking more, because of the pandemic, about making sure they have a will. We'll find out if it's something individuals can do on their own, or do they need the help of an attorney to make sure everything is settled correctly. We'll also discuss what kind of trends in family law have been happening since the pandemic began. Call with your questions, 575-646-2212, for Voice of the Public. And we'll begin right after NPR News on KRWG Public Media. Good afternoon. It's 1:06 and time for Voice of the Public on KRWG Public Media. And with the two guests we have today, my presence is probably not really even needed except to push a couple of buttons. We're pleased to be joined by Jessica Streeter of Streeter Law Firm, LLC. Good afternoon, Jessica.
Good afternoon.
And by Alan D. Gluth of Gluth Law, LLC. Welcome, Alan.
Thank you. Nice to be with you.
Before we get started, I just want to announce our content today should not be considered legal advice. You should contact an attorney before completing any legal documents. Jessica, why don't we begin with you? Just tell us a little bit about yourself and your area of expertise.
Sure. Thank you very much. I am Jessica Streeter. I was raised here in Las Cruces, and my background initially when I got out of law school, I was a public defender, so I did a lot of criminal defense, and I was also a special assistant attorney general doing child support, and that's how I got introduced to family law. I own a small firm, and we have three attorneys, all female. I specialize mostly in family law, though I do a little bit of criminal defense still, and the tiniest bit of estate planning, mostly in the context of people getting divorced or adding children onto their families. The other attorneys in my office do some landlord-tenant law and some estate planning, guardian ad litem work, and other kinds of family law.
All right. And Alan, how about yourself?
Yes, I attended the University of Texas Law School, and after law school, I worked at a large firm doing estate planning and probate law in downtown El Paso, and have practiced in estate planning, probate, and trust law for the last 23 years. The last 11 years, I have operated through my own firm, Gluth Law. We have five employees and are based in Las Cruces, and have a large amount of experience doing estate planning, probate, and trust law for people in the community, and I'm also board certified in estate planning and probate law by the Texas Board of Legal Specialization.
575-646-2212. That's the telephone number to call if you have a question for Jessica or Ellen or both. We would love to hear from you today on Voice of the Public. I want to begin, Alan, with you in terms of this pandemic and how it has spurred so many people to really think about this kind of planning. Just a quick story. My own friend, I'm blucka years old, and I have no will. But I've talked about it and talked about it for years, and my friends and I have talked about it, and we just kept putting it off. But this pandemic made one of those very dear friends get that done. She's a teacher and especially susceptible to this disease. Have you seen an increase in people, you know, wanting to make sure their estates are settled?
Absolutely. We have been overwhelmed for the last number of months doing estate planning work for people who are thinking about their own mortality, worried about being in the hospital or being incapacitated. And so we're spending a lot of time working with not only existing clients who are updating their documents and making sure that they're current in terms of who they've named under their powers of attorney or how they're leaving assets under a will or trust, but also a large influx of new clients who are wanting to perhaps do a will and powers of attorney for the first time. And so, yes, we have seen a tremendous interest in this with a lot of people. And while a lot of people are struggling, I can say this because of this area of law, we have strong job security is the best way I would put it.
Mm, yeah. And Jessica, one of the things we hear over time is that when there's a bad economy, there are fewer divorces because people can't afford it. But you've seen something different during this particular situation, right?
Yeah, we happily have been able to help people through some of this. Honestly, sometimes people come and see us, and we don't always advise them to start with the divorce process. If it sounds like they're just kind of having a hard time, we advise them to, you know, see if there's some kind of couples counseling. But we have seen the divorces that come through our firm have not decreased as a result of a struggling economy. And a lot of times people talk about the difference in their day-to-day lives and the stresses with their spouse based on the pandemic being one of the causes of having taken a toll on their marriage to the point where they want to get a divorce.
Mm. We have a caller on the line holding with a question. Good afternoon, Donna. Thank you for calling Voice of the Public.
Hi.
Hi, Donna. Do you have your radio on in the background? And if it's close by, can you turn it down? Thank you.
Okay. Yeah. So my question is for either or. If I had an elderly person who passed and did not have a will or any of that situation, and I am now left in charge of their estate, how does one go about handling that?
Alan, you want to take this one?
Sure, absolutely. So when an elderly person passes away, there's a number of initial considerations that have to be considered. First and foremost, did the person pass away with a last will and testament or not?
Absolutely.
And so in this case, if there's no will, then we have to look at the law that New Mexico and Texas, every state has laws that state who the heirs are, who are the individuals who are going to receive this individual's assets. And then that's going to depend on that person's family situation. Was the person married? Did the person have children? Is their parents surviving, siblings surviving? And there's a methodical process to be able to analyze that and to see who the heirs are. That's step one. Step two is, we have to look asset by asset to determine how each asset will pass, because not every asset passes to the heirs per se, because a lot of assets may pass in accordance with a beneficiary designation, meaning they have, say, a retirement account or a life insurance policy, and they may have already named someone in that paperwork to receive that particular asset, in which case the person named as beneficiary claims that asset from the company. Alternatively, sometimes there's a co-owner on an asset. Take, for example, a checking account. If someone has a checking account when they pass away, but there's a co-owner, generally the surviving co-owner then is the owner of that bank account, and it does not pass to the heirs. So it's really a two-part analysis here. We have to understand the family situation, determine who the heirs are, and then we have to look at each asset and see if there's a beneficiary or co-owner on it.
Okay. So do you guys have any... I'm actually in that situation right now, so I was wondering if I could get seen with either guy.
Oh, sure. Do you you want to take down a phone number?
Yeah.
Okay, Alan, go ahead.
Yes, if my office phone number is 575-556-8449, and generally, when we're dealing with these types of estates, and you can call my office and schedule an appointment, and we can go through it and evaluate the situation. But what's very helpful, because I get a lot of calls when people pass away, and people are saying, what do I need to do? What do I need to gather? So the biggest thing is getting names, addresses, phone numbers for all of the relatives and family members that may be related to the person who died. We need a death certificate. And then we need to have a list, an informal list of assets and liabilities for the person. And then with that information, we're going to be in a position to be able to analyze the situation and determine how assets pass and whether a probate may be needed.
Okay. All right. Well, great. Now I have your number, and you will be hearing from me.
Thank you, Donna, for calling,
great.
And good luck with the process. That kind of took care of really my first question, is what happens when you pass away without a will? Do you think you kind of covered the whole process, or is there something else that we should know that will happen if we don't have a will? Jessica?
I think Alan mostly covered most of the issues, I would say. I know that there are other things to look for, right? You should have, like Alan said, a list of assets and liabilities. Those would be things like credit cards and other kinds of debts. But if I usually recommend to my clients, if they don't know of any will, seeing if you can find any documents showing where all of the assets and liabilities are and bringing those into the office, that'll help us sort things through for that as well.
Yeah. It is 116, and 575-646-2212 is the telephone number to call. Voice of the public. During the pandemic, many people are thinking more about their mortality. And, you know, at what age, Alan, should someone get a will?
Well, I recommend to clients that anyone who owns any assets, and it can be very modest, anyone who has any type of asset and who's older than is 18 or older should generally have a will. Now, as a practical matter, most individuals who are young and have modest assets typically are not getting wills because they're not worried about it. They believe they're going to live a long time and there's no real urgency. But where it becomes much more important to get a will is not, even if you have assets, is if you have a child. Mm-hmm. Because once you have a child, not only do you need to say how assets are going to pass under a will, but in the will, you can also designate who will be guardian of that minor child or that new child if you pass away. Now, obviously the other parent, if it's a spouse, maybe it's not a spouse, but if one parent passes away, the surviving parent would automatically become the guardian for that child. But to really cover your bases in case that both parents passed away, designating that guardian of who would raise that child if that child was under age 18 is a proactive, appropriate thing to do, and that's covered in a will. So, and also you can set up how, if you're leaving money to that minor child, you can set up a trust through a will so that the assets are managed for that minor child. So that's when I typically see younger individuals getting a will, is once they're starting a family, they want to make sure they've done adequate planning for their newborn child, their children.
Thank you. We have Lonnie on the line calling with a question. Good afternoon, Lonnie. Thank you for calling today.
Thank you. We have Lonnie on the line.
Lonnie, turn down your radio if you can. I know it may be hard to hear me and that at the same time. Are you with us?
Yes.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
Yes, I'd like to ask, what are the differences between a will and a trust, and what are the advantages of having one over the other?
Alan? Jessica?
Sure. I'll add a few comments and then let Jessica add her thoughts. But a will versus a trust really has to do with the method by which assets will pass at death. With a will, which most people have, a will has to go through probate, meaning that in order for a will to be considered valid, there has to be a personal representative appointed. And in order to do that, the will gets filed with the court approves the will, and then the judge appoints that personal representative and issues what are called letters testamentary. And there's other documents that also have to be done as a part of a probate, various notices to beneficiaries, notice to creditors. And so that court process is referred to as probate. And so Unfortunately, in New Mexico, probate is not a monumental task as it is in other states such as Florida and California. Probate's relatively simple in New Mexico, whereas a trust is a little bit more involved to set up because it involves transferring your assets into the name of the trust, but a trust does not go through probate. So it allows assets to be transferred to the beneficiaries in a more seamless way at death. But again, it takes a little bit more work up front to fund the trust. But a trust is working just like a will. But it's a probate avoidance technique is the trust, the living trust. I'm referring to a living trust, revocable trust, revocable trust, whatever you want to call it. But two other quick points. A living trust does not magically shelter your assets from creditors, and it does not in and of itself save any taxes. It is really a vehicle to be used to make allow assets to pass at death in a more seamless way and avoid probate.
Okay. Thank you very much, Lonnie, for your question this afternoon. Jessica, do you have anything to add to that?
No, honestly, as Alan was talking, I was thinking he's doing an excellent job answering the question.
You did
great, Alan.
That puts you in an awkward position, but I did have a follow-up for you, Jessica, and something we just kind of heard little tidbits about as well. A couple of things. First of all, your liabilities. So do I want to be in somebody's will if they have a whole bunch of credit card debt?
I think I'm going to let Alan answer that one.
So let me ask, share a few thoughts on debts, because this comes up a lot, where an individual passes away, they have a large amount of debt but modest assets, and we would typically refer to that as an insolvent estate. Mm. And so when we have those debts, the general rule is that when a person dies, the heirs, the people who are entitled to receive the assets, are not liable for the decedent's debts. So what's frequently, and people are sometimes surprised to hear this, but when a person passes away, their assets are supposed to be used to pay off any outstanding debts, and then whatever assets are remaining then pass to the beneficiaries under the will or the heirs if there's no will. But if the liabilities exceed the assets, and again, it called an insolvent estate, then if the assets get depleted to pay debts and there's still debt outstanding, then the creditors are essentially out of luck. And so we do encounter that from time to time. And so when that does happen, it is common that creditors, particularly, say, credit card companies, sometimes medical providers, those debts get written off because they're simply not assets to pay them. So there are other considerations with debt when a person dies. There are some assets that are protected from paying creditor claims. There's detailed laws that need to be followed in paying debts. There's a priority for payment of debts, of which debts are supposed to be paid before others. For example, funeral expenses are the first priority and must be paid first. And so my recommendation to anyone that's dealing with this situation is, and this is not a plug for attorneys, but dealing with creditors can become somewhat complicated. And I recommend to individuals that may be dealing with debts of a decedent to consult with an attorney that can guide them through that situation.
Jessica, I bet debt is a huge factor in your practice and how you are dealing with families who are going their separate ways.
Yes, it definitely is. I mostly deal with debts, as you're saying, in terms of divorces. And sometimes we see the same thing where people are upside down. They don't have enough assets basically to split to make it so that they have enough to pay off all of their debts with money left over to divide up between the parties. That happens sometimes. Usually what happens if people have debt plus assets and it's about equal, we just try to divide up the debts and the assets equally. So if somebody keeps the house, they'll also keep the mortgage. And if that mortgage is significant, the other person will get their share of the equity out of the house, but then we'll also take maybe a few more credit cards or something like that.
I see. One question here, off-air question. Is a holographic will legal in New Mexico?
That's a good question. So let's make sure we first understand what a holographic will is. A holographic will is a will that a person writes out entirely in their own handwriting. It's not typed. And then they sign it. So literally someone gets a sheet of notebook paper and says, this is my last will and testament. And then they write out, this is how I want my assets to pass, et cetera, et cetera. So is that legal? If it's just signed by the person preparing the will, in New Mexico, the answer is no. A holographic will is not legal in New Mexico. However, a holographic will in Texas can be legal. So the laws between Texas and New Mexico are a little bit different on this topic. But the general rule, so a handwritten rule, a will is not necessarily invalid. It just has to be signed the right way, which means you can write out your own will. You sign it, but it must be witnessed by two witnesses who must sign in your presence and in the presence of each other. So even if you do write out your own will and you sign it with two witnesses present and they sign it, while it is technically a valid will in that instance, then there's still some other issues that can still be encountered in having that will being considered valid by a court. And there's some additional evidentiary steps that have to be taken. But the quick answer to the question is that a holographic will where a person writes out their will and signs it without witnesses, that is not a valid will in New Mexico.
I was quite sure it was going to be Obi-Wan Kenobi style. Right. I mean, it's 2021. Right. So, Jessica, looks like a question for you.
Sure.
Should one do estate planning at the end of a divorce and how to protect their kids or heirs when a marriage ends?
Yeah, that is a great question. And yes, we often do talk about having somebody update their will or redo something at the end of the divorce. One of the attorneys who works for me is much more well-versed in estate planning, and she usually handles that part of it. But yes, as a general matter, that is one of the things that we do for closing out divorces is tell them this is a thing to consider.
All right, 575-646-2212, the telephone number to call if you have a question for Voice of the Public. This afternoon, we have attorney Jessica Streeter of Streeter Law Firm, LLC, and Alan Gluth of Gluth Law, LLC, joining us today to help answer these questions that are questions we often just kind of think about and then put off and put off and put off. And in so many cases, we put it off till it's too late. And just like our very first caller, you know, finds herself in that situation dealing with an estate that did not have a will. A couple of other questions that came in before we started the show today. Estate planning for people who don't have much in the way of property or assets, may one set this up by his or herself in New Mexico? So if it's not a holographic will in New Mexico, are there resources where you can do DIY your will?
That's a good question. There's a lot of misinformation out there regarding wills. There's a lot of forms that you can find, whether at a bookstore or on the internet. And I've seen come across a lot of those types of wills and documents. And my general advice on that is the buyer beware, because sometimes a will form that you may find on the internet or in a bookstore or even powers of attorney may be generic in nature and be filled out, but sometimes the language does not quite fit for New Mexico law. Sometimes it's not signed properly, in which case it's not valid. Because when we talk about wills and powers of attorney, the law governing those are state-specific. In other words, New Mexico has its own official forms for, say, a financial power of attorney or a New Mexico advanced directive for medical decisions and its own requirements for signing a will. And so the biggest issue I find with do-it-yourself, when you find those types of documents online or in a book or packet, is they're more national forms. They're not state-specific, and so sometimes those forms don't quite fit for New Mexico law. Sometimes they will work. And so, again, this is not a plug necessary for lawyers, but the only way a person can be confident that the powers of attorney or will that they have works that they may have done on their own is to consult with an attorney. And I do that frequently, where people will want to meet with me and they've already tried to do the documents on their own and they've signed them. And I'm generally willing to meet with someone, look at the paperwork they've done, and just advise them, yes, this works under New Mexico law, or no, it doesn't. And sometimes they'll pay me a very small fee just to consult with them on that. But it is possible. But it does take some research to be able to know what New Mexico law requires to do the documents on your own.
I got to say, there are a couple of times, so many examples that we've all seen. There are a couple of times when families seem to just lose their minds, and that's when there's a divorce and when there's a death. And Jessica, I want to talk about, just even though you put all the pieces together in those situations, what do you have to be prepared for even after you've done all of the work that you think you should have to do?
In terms of...
I would say,
sorry,
challenges and ongoing battles between family members or exes.
With regard to, like, a divorce?
It could be a divorce or a death, right? There are so many cases where we just see people, normally rational people, you know, really doing things that they wouldn't probably normally do. So if you're going through this process, what do you need to keep in mind in terms of, you know, what could still be on the horizon, say, after a divorce? Do couples find themselves back in court?
You know, oftentimes we find people back in court if there are ongoing custody battles. And with regard to both the challenges for, like, a will or for a divorce, I would say an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. And so if you have some documents in place that you feel comfortable with, it's always worth having an attorney look them over. A lot of times people come in for me, even for a divorce or for child support issues or whatever, and they say, this is what we've agreed to, this is what we want to do. And again, same thing like Alan, I'll kind of tell them, that sounds good, that this is what the law in New Mexico is, and that'll work. Or sometimes we have the conversation where I say, this is what the law in New Mexico is, this is what I generally see judges do, and if the other person wanted to challenge this in the future, these are the problems that I would see for you. So I think really having a good understanding of what your rights are, what the law is, and what your documents actually say is worth it before you start getting into litigation. I'll also just note one more tip that I have for everybody is always try to have a good idea of what your financial situation is. And if you're married, that's equally as important as when you're getting divorced, which is equally as important when, let's say, one person is older and or sick or something, and it looks like you might have to end up using a will sometime in the future. Having a good understanding of where your finances are and where all the documents are for all of those things is important so that you have a good understanding of what your framework is now, currently, before you head into court or have to use any kind of legal document in the future.
And Alan, in terms of families, it seems like, you know, maybe the siblings never liked each other all along the way, but there's fight after fight that we see when a parent passes away. And I'm wondering if you can add to that in terms of what, you know, what mechanisms you can use to try to minimize it at least. Alan, are you still with us? I think we may have lost Alan.
Oh, no.
I'll have to see if we can get reconnected. Doesn't look like... Engineer Jake is on the job. He's going to go see what's going on there. So Jessica, I'll move on to your next question then. It's just you and me now for the moment, okay?
Sure.
134 at KRWG. And if you would like to ask a question this afternoon on Voice of the Public, please call 575-646-2212. We actually did have a question coming in via Facebook. And the question is, if I have a will from Texas and live in New Mexico, should I change it?
I think it's always worth taking your will into a New Mexico attorney and seeing whether or not the language that is in there is sufficient for what New Mexico courts would expect. As Alan said, the law between New Mexico and Texas is very different in a variety of ways, and in terms of wills and probates is one way, and also in terms of just family law generally is another way. So I would say if you have a will from Texas, it's worth at least taking it into a New Mexico attorney and making sure that that language would transfer over nicely.
All right. It's 1:35 at KRWG, and I think we're still trying to connect with Alan. Alan, are you with us? Are you back with us? Hello, KRWG. Alan, are you with us? I don't, the line's open, but I don't hear Alan there. Anyway, so we'll keep trying to reconnect there. And in the meantime, I know he was calling my, I'm getting the old shaking the head back and forth there. Live radio.
Oh,
gotta
no.
love it. Gotta love it. I did have another question, actually, coming in off-air question, and it was about small businesses and protecting your own small business. With an LLC, should you become disabled or even have to go into a nursing home? Let's talk about how important that is for small businesses.
Sure. I mean, an LLC can definitely protect your business, protect your assets. I think it's important to make sure that you're working with a variety of professionals if you do want to form an LLC, and that would be an attorney to help you draft your documents, but also your accountant who can give you good information about whether or not an LLC, a sole proprietorship, or a corporation is the way to go with regard to protecting your assets for that.
All right, 646-2212 here at KRWG. Thank you for joining us if you're listening on the radio or following along on Facebook as well. We appreciate you being with us today. Christian has a question. What online tools could you recommend that are legal and would hold up in court? Do we have resources there?
You know, I've had some people bring in documents from LegalZoom, and it's the same thing that Alan said. Sometimes we'll just kind of review those documents and see whether or not they'll work out. But it's just kind of buyer beware. Sometimes they're hit or miss. Sometimes they're just fine. And a lot of times, especially if it's just kind of a simple, basic thing, a LegalZoom kind of document or some other kind of LegalZoom like business, mm-hmm. Those are often fine. But the more complex your issue is, the less likely it is that the LegalZoom document is going to work out for you. The hard part is a lot of times people don't know whether or not they are one of the ones who has a complex issue until you go see the attorney and they can kind of walk you through it. Again, I'm like Alan. I'm not, you know, saying that everything needs to go through an attorney. It's just usually best to at least see if an attorney can look at your documents to see whether or not things are going well.
And what should someone expect when it comes to cost? And let's talk about both the cost of a divorce and the cost of your estate plan.
Sure. So, again, I think that depends on the complexity. Generally speaking, with regard to divorces, the more assets, debts, and other complicating factors there are, the higher the retainer. So the way that we do it here is for a divorce, or some kind of ongoing process, you put down a retainer, and then attorneys and paralegals work on your case, and we charge an hourly fee. And then at the end of each month, you pull money out of the retainer to pay the invoice. So you sometimes hear people talking about having, you know, quote, a lawyer on retainer. That's what that is. Somebody has given a lawyer some money to hold in a trust account that's separate from their lawyer's actual business account, and they don't move that trust money until after they've done the work and invoiced you, then they move move the money out of trust. So it just kind of depends. A lot of times if it's a particularly contentious divorce, we have people fighting over children or fighting over especially hidden assets can get very expensive very quickly trying to track those down. But same thing kind of with the estate planning side. If it's just kind of a simple will, we do more flat fee packages for estate planning stuff. If it's a simple will, it's much more affordable than something that's a bigger trust estate, because as Alan said, setting up a trust takes a lot more work up front, funding the trust, making sure everything is set up properly. And the money that you spend up front on the trust is often, you know, worth it to save going through the probate process and also the cost of going through probate at the end. So it just kind of depends. I'll tell you, too, I know that you didn't ask this question, but another issue that we've seen a lot in terms of family law cases with regard to the pandemic is when somebody in one household is exposed to COVID and there are children that two different households are sharing, what happens then? A lot of times people have, you know, custody plans and things like that that they have to follow. But if somebody gets exposed, what happens then? And sometimes clients will come in and we'll have to go to court to deal with it. But as I said before, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. And if people can kind of agree at the beginning of it what they're going to do, what the household's plans are with regard to exposure, with regard to positive tests, with regard to quarantining, then nobody has to go talk to their lawyer to say, hurry, hurry, let's run into court because they won't give me my kid back or because they've exposed my child or, you know, things like that.
Wow, what a new level of complexity for an already complex situation.
Yeah.
We have a couple more questions coming in here off air, and our engineer Jake is still trying to reconnect with Alan. So just so you know, I believe I'm getting calls from him from his office on my cell phone, which is funny because it's not connected to a radio board, so I wouldn't be able to put him on the air that way, of course.
Right.
But he is. And so if you are trying to call to be a part of the program right now and you're not getting an answer, apologies, but that's why, because Jake, who does everything else except Gab on the air, is right now trying to reconnect with Alan, so we'll get him back on as soon as possible. But here's our next question. What happens to my estate documents once the way it's worded is once drafted? Oh, I see, once drafted. There's just a little typo there. Do you have to file them somewhere, or does the attorney keep them?
So what I recommend is after all of the estate planning documents are executed, telling your lawyer where those documents are and then telling other people, particularly, right, if it's a will, you're going to want to tell the person who you want to be appointed as the personal representative, telling that person where it is. Some people have safety deposit boxes. I know some attorneys do keep the original copies of the will. We tend to recommend that people hold on to them themselves, because if something were to happen and I were to close down my office or something and people don't update their contact information with me, then I am in a position of having the will, and then that person may not, you know, remember where I am, or if they pass away, their relatives might not know where to find that information for me later down the line. So I tend to keep those in my records and where the will is, and then tell people to keep their own estate planning documents in a safe place and tell their family members where they are as well.
All right. Cross your fingers, Jessica.
All right.
Okay. Both hands.
Both hands and my heels.
Hi, Alan. Are you back with us?
I am back.
Hi, Alan.
I don't know what happened, but somehow got dropped from the program. So I'm back, and I'm glad we're back up and running.
Yeah. Well, we missed you, but we do have a couple of callers on the line that are holding with questions. So let's get to Candace. Good afternoon, Candace. How are you?
I'm well, and you?
Good, thank you. What do you have for us today?
Well, my husband and I have been discussing doing a will. We have it set up right now, so where if anything happens to either one of us, all of our assets go to the other person. My question is, can we do a will together, or do we each have to do a will? Say, you know, we were to both go in an accident or something. So we're covered as far as if one goes in and, you know, before the other, but what about if we both go? Can we do one joint will?
That's a good question. So what used to happen a long time ago in 1800s, early 1900s, doing a joint will where a husband and wife did one document to cover both spouses was fairly common. Today, that is almost never done. So the quick answer is I strongly recommend that each spouse has their own will. Now, each will would leave everything to each other, but you already have it set that way. But then it would say, if my spouse does not survive me, then there's the plan of how the assets pass when you both pass away. And then that plan would be in both of your wills, but it would only take effect once when the second spouse dies. So the reason why a joint will doesn't work very well is if a will has to be probated when the first spouse dies, which sometimes happens, the original will has to be filed at the courthouse, and it stays there forever. And so I've seen instances where you have the joint will, and you have to file it when the first spouse dies because there's an asset only in that spouse's name, and then the surviving spouse doesn't have possession of their original will. And so I strongly recommend that each spouse has their own last will and testament, but those wills will dovetail and mirror each other to make sure that the overall plan that you want is still followed.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Candace, for calling. Good to hear from you. And we have two lines occupied, and Francis has been holding, waiting patiently with a question. Thank you for calling, Francis. Good afternoon. Hi, Francis. Are you with us?
Hi, yes.
Do you have a question for us this afternoon?
Yes. I wanted some information on transfer on death deed. I'm originally from Georgia, and when I came to New Mexico, I had my will redone by an attorney here in New Mexico, and he asked me if I wanted to do a transfer on death deed. And the way I understand it is that, you know, I could transfer my house at the time of my death to one of my children. But this is not something that I'm really familiar with, so I just wondered if the lawyers would comment on this.
Well, I can give a quick summary, and Jessica, you can add your thoughts. But transfer on death deeds are very common in New Mexico, and I think they can really come in to help individuals because the transfer on death deed can avoid probate. So think of it this way. A transfer on death deed is where you're basically putting a beneficiary on your home. And so the deed basically says, if I own this home when I pass away, I want it to pass to this person or these people automatically. And so then you sign that transfer on death deed. It gets recorded at the county building, and then it's of record. And so if you pass away with that transfer on death deed recorded, then all that's needed for the person named, say it's one of your children, then that child would take your death certificate after you pass away, record the death certificate with the county, and then that child's considered the owner of the home. It's that simple. And, of course, a transfer on death deed can be revoked or changed at any point. And then some people say, well, what if I sell the home? What happens to the transfer on death deed? And in that case, well, the transfer on death deed just doesn't apply anymore because you're no longer the owner. You don't have to go separately revoke it. So transfer on death deeds can work very well. You just have to realize that if whoever you name to receive the property when you pass away, that person predeceases you, well, you have to change your transfer on death deed. So, but I like transfer on death deeds and prepare them for clients all the time because it does avoid having to probate a will otherwise sometimes.
Well, what about putting two people on? Is that just complicating things? Or is it better just to have one person?
You can have two people, but I try to recommend to clients to think that through. Well, do these two people get along? So if they're co-owners of the property, are they going to agree on how the property is used? If there's a possibility that they may not be good co-owners or not get along, then sometimes naming two people in the transfer of death deed won't work. But also, if you name two people in a transfer and death deed, you have to cover in the deed what happens if one of those two people predeceases you. So they do work, and you can do a transfer on death deed with two people. You just have to think through those possibilities. If one predeceases, what's going to happen? Does it all go to just the one person, or does it go to the deceased person's children? And then are they going to be good co-owners and work together if they own the property jointly?
Right. Well, now about the issue of Medicaid and its relationship to home ownership. You know, if you are in some kind of nursing home care where you're receiving Medicaid, is that is that related at all?
What I would say on that is Medicaid is its own creature out there, and qualifying for Medicaid and owning a home can become fairly complicated. There are attorneys in New Mexico who specialize entirely on Medicaid law, and I recommend that clients consult with those type of Medicaid attorneys. There are rules about still qualifying for Medicaid while still owning a home, but as a lot of people hear out in the press, there's this concept of estate recovery, where if you qualify for Medicaid and own a home but then pass away, that the state can then come and take the home, have it sold, and then get reimbursed for the money they paid. But again, that's a fairly complicated topic, and to be able to cover all the ins and outs of it on a program like this. But my advice for those that are wanting to qualify for Medicaid, that it's really important to talk to an attorney who specializes in Medicaid, because there's a lot of ins and outs to it.
Thank you very much for the question. We have just a few minutes left. You probably wouldn't have had enough time to get into those ins and outs in the remaining 8 minutes that we have. So, Joel, good afternoon. Welcome to Voice of the Public. Thank you for calling.
Hello.
Go ahead.
Could your attorneys just go through all of the steps involved in drawing up the will, what happens after the person dies, probating it, settling the state? Everything, step by step. You start out, obviously, by drawing up the will. Does it have to be notarized? Does it have to be witnessed?
I think a lot of these things that, unfortunately, if you're just joining us, Joel, a lot of them are things that we have covered going back to the beginning of the hour. But maybe there's a place where we can talk about where someone could find that information if they're wondering about the step-by-step process.
Well, what I'd like is just a brief step-by-step, 1, 2, 3, 4 of all the steps. I probated my mother's will in Texas.
Okay.
So I'd just like to go through the steps just very quickly about what everything that happens.
All right. Alan?
Well, I'll try to keep it very brief, but there's the steps before death and then after death. Of course, before death, to have a will, you got to have a valid will, and that has to be signed, prepared and signed with two witnesses. Typically, to do it properly, there's a self-proving affidavit at the end where the person signs the will with two witnesses and it's notarized and has all the right language at the end. So the key language, especially if you want to do for the research, is the will needs to be self-proven, and that requires two witnesses and a notary. Then the will's fine. It's legal. It says who gets what. Person passes away. And then generally, that will is going to have to be probated and have to be filed with the court. Now, every county in New Mexico has a probate court, and there's a probate judge. And every one of those probate judges in their office, they have a packet that members of the public can obtain. And in that packet, it goes through all of the steps that have to be taken when someone passes away. And there's all these forms. And so there's so many steps that I could get into, and it would take a half hour to cover them. But my advice is, after someone passes away with a will, and you want to know kind of a checklist of the things that need to be done, either consult with an attorney or consider getting a packet from your local probate court in New Mexico.
All right.
That county probate judge.
Okay, just a couple other questions. Does the will have to be registered with the county, or is just a piece of paper is sufficient?
Well, once a will is signed, when someone's alive, the will is not filed with the county. It's not recorded anywhere.
Okay,
the will's just, I think I heard Jessica say previously, and I agree with her, once the will's signed, it should just stay in your own possession.
Okay, very good.
But the will may have to be filed after death in order for the will to become effective through probate.
Right. Now, are there any qualifications required of the executor, like the residence of the executor or anything like that?
That's a good question. So the law on that generally says that an executor that you name can live anywhere in the world.
Okay.
So the person does not have to be a resident of New Mexico, or if you're listening, anyone in Texas, it doesn't have to be a resident of Texas. So that is not a requirement. You can appoint anyone wherever they're at, but frequently, though, whoever's appointed, if they live out of state, there's a high likelihood they will have to travel to New Mexico in order to deal with the assets and liabilities.
Right.
So you have to keep that in mind.
Right.
Okay.
All right, very good. And that's excellent information about the probate judge's office. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you, Joel. Good luck. And Maggie, you've been waiting patiently. Thank you so much for calling this afternoon. Hi, Maggie. You're on Voice of the Public. What's your question?
Hello. I would have called earlier, but I forgot about the show and I went to Walmart. So I have just a couple of quick questions. I have the packet, and it includes the documents called the Five Wishes. But I have a couple of questions. I am a 73-year-old widow. I do not have any children. I really am kind of over the barrel to know how to handle who to leave anything to or who to be an executor. So my question is, I have a couple questions. Would I be better off to choose a lawyer to be the executor if I can't figure out anybody that I trust enough to do this kind of thing? Another question I have is Social Security something you can leave behind to someone if you don't have children?
So I'm happy to try to tackle those quickly. I know time is somewhat short. So let me answer the second question first. Social Security is all driven by federal law, and so no, that is not something you can leave to someone else. The only person who can benefit from your own Social Security is going to be a surviving spouse. But other relatives, you can't leave any Social Security benefits to anyone else at your death. The first question had to do with, if you are single and have no children, I would just say, without getting into the details, that type of person needs to have a number of documents, not just a will. Particularly need someone to name who can deal with your remains, who has authority to either ensure that you're buried or cremated. Also should do powers of attorney in case you're incapacitated to make medical and financial decisions. The last part, though, in naming a lawyer to be in charge. Some lawyers will do that as a service, obviously with a fee. Most lawyers, in my experience, don't. I typically have a policy that I will not serve as the personal representative because I feel a little bit like it's a conflict of interest. But most lawyers, I think, could point you to individuals and companies that will serve in that role.
Okay, and when I finish the document, writing them myself, I'm pretty good at doing that. Should I file the will myself at the courthouse because I am single?
I think that's problematic, to be honest. While you are technically allowed to deposit your will for safekeeping at the courthouse, I don't think that's the best course of action. I recommend you just keep the will in your possession and make sure that whoever you name as personal representative, that that person knows where you keep your original will in your home.
All right. And with that, I'm so sorry, Maggie. We are out of time. I wish we had more time. Jessica and Alan, thank you both. I didn't even get a chance to dive into the topic of what you're both seeing in terms of pets. And how people take care of their pets once they're either splitting up or passing on. So clearly there was just a huge amount of interest in the topic today, and we would love it if you would be willing to come back and join us another time. Jessica?
Oh, I would love to. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for spending the hour with us today. And Alan, would you do the same?
Absolutely. Anytime.
It was wonderful.
Really enjoyed it.
And before you go, Jessica, give us your office telephone number one more time, please.
Certainly. It's 575-652-3345.
And Alan, yours?
Sure, 575-556-8449.
All right. Have a wonderful weekend, and thank you for joining us this afternoon for Voice of the Public. Leora Zeitlin is coming up next with Intermezzo by Request. That's right after NPR News on KRWG.